Time to check in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for our last Tacky Talk of March 2023, actually. How are you, Tacky?
Hey, Joe. It's running across our anniversary of our get-together.
That's right. Yeah, coming up on 3 years. Wow, my gosh, a lot has happened in a short period of time.
Oh, absolutely. It's been such a rocky and crazy ride for 3 years that hopefully none of us will ever have to live through again. But I mean, it's always been a wonderful time with you as we reach our anniversary. I don't know what a three anniversary on a podcast interview should be. Is there a holiday or a special stone involved? I have no idea.
Well, the first one that we did, I was in my office at home with my cat in the background. So things have changed.
Well, yeah, so trying to figure out how to get proper lighting on the fly.
Exactly. Yeah. So obviously, as we talked about before, this form of communication is here to stay in some fashion, both professionally and personally too.
Absolutely. I mean, this morning I held my committee briefing for the committee members regarding what the committee roles is, what the policies are, different topics we manage, introduction of our staffs electronically through the medium of Zoom. You know, it's not a public briefing. It's just to tell, you know, members, hey, we're doing the following things. This is what the committee looks like. These are the topics we deal with. Here's our staff. Here's what they look like. Here's their email and phone numbers. You need to find us. I mean, it's really kind of a, you know, get people up to speed. I do understand that everyone's schedule is very busy. People don't realize that people have many conflicts, particularly members who have multiple committees tied up in different places. And, you know, I'm going to have to do this again in, I'm not sure what format, maybe in Zoom format or one-on-one with members who are not available today. And even text messaging. I mean, you know, I sent 3 reminder texts, as well as 2 emails to remind folks. And I said I have four new members, but you know, people are sitting on 3 other committees, and public hearings have begun. And it's challenging as a chair managing members and the staff and a numerator of policy topics, plus you know, personal legislation, plus district stuff. There's a lot of responsibilities. But, you know, like I say before, and I'll say again, I believe the chairs have a responsibility to bring new members up to speed on these policy issues and provide some guidance as they learn these topics during the course of a session.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, with remote work now never going away, probably to some regard, how's that, or has it changed the commercial real estate market? Is the concern of the State House about, you know, loss of commercial development, commercial tax base because of that?
Well, there's a lot of really important points there, right? I mean, the MBTA is not at full capacity. I do know the MBTA has a lot of problems, but they're far from full capacity still, reflecting the fact that a lot of white-collar workers are not coming from the suburbs into Boston. And, you know, whether it be Quincy or Boston or Cambridge or any other metropolitan area with significant office space, there's a lot of question whether or not those leases will be renewed. Like I said, during the pandemic, I have some friends in the lobbying business, and they didn't renew their office space. They 2020, 21 didn't renew. They moved all their stuff to a storage, and you know, were reevaluating their finances about whether they can afford a Boston commercial prices, or they can downsize significantly and do remote work. And also, a lot of out of state folks have not been coming to Massachusetts to represent their businesses. A lot of them are still using this format we're in to represent themselves and have meetings with legislators and staff, and even with their own government affairs and attorneys they hire in Massachusetts. So yeah, I mean, the office space is a legit question about whether to continue, as well as also sadly, you know, businesses that are struggling because of lack of downtown workers, restaurants, cobblers, even retail. I mean, you know, a lot of downtown crossing retail is designed around commuter workers to be able to, you know, do some quick, you know, get a Macy's or TJX and just get in there and, you know, get their stuff and get back on the train, right? So the downtown business is really designed around a commuter working industry and, of course, tourism. So I don't see this changing quickly. I know there's you see in news a lot of business like Twitter and Google now and Apple, they're all trying to get people back to the office. I personally believe there's a lot of in-person benefits in terms of efficiency, getting things done, body language easier to read. I think communication's faster in person. Team building's a lot easier in person. You can't play Zoom app games to do team building as opposed to sitting down and, you know, working through things together. And we are doing hybrid hearings at sales. We're having in-person and virtual simultaneous. I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out. And it's given the state website, the legislature's website a few times, or every time now in the broadcast here, we're trying to figure out how to do that technology away from just Zoom and do in-person hybrid. But I mean, the mayor of Boston has a lot of challenges. I mean, particularly the mayor of Boston. I mean, she has proposed a lot of changes of how to do development. She's put out essentially a new stretch code that may, I think it will actually more than may, change the cost of construction in Boston significantly to meet these new requirements she's looking for that are more environmentally friendly. Of course, you know, inflation is here, but also high interest rates. And at some point, a lot of developers are going to have to get new loans because the developments now, you know, are using loans they got secured like the last 5 years when the rates were really low. And new developments going to have to get new financing and the rates are going to be significantly higher. So I'm not sure it's going to go, but I mean, you're right. This current office space issue and this question about what new development's going to look like, it isn't housing.
Right. And I know in the governor's proposed budget, there's some changes in the tax code that she's trying to address folks leaving Massachusetts, you know, to flee to lower tax, quote unquote, lower tax states.
Yeah, that's not new. I mean, we all know that people move on to warmer climates and lower tax states, especially retirees, because, you know, common sense. I mean, you don't have a home. Your nest is empty, or you have a home to take care of, and maybe it's time to downsize to warm weather and low taxes. However, you know, they also discover, and have friends who move down to low tax warmer states, that the healthcare system is not the same, and services are not the same. It's like city folks that go to towns and find they have to take your garbage to a dump. Right? Same principle. You know, it's like, why do I have to take my garbage to a dump? I'm in a wealthier, smaller community. I'm like, well, that's what they do there. So it's not surprising to me that a lot of folks keep their homes that have means, will keep their homes in Massachusetts to maintain some level of residency for the summertime, seeing family. But again, you have to have the means to do it. If you got money, I don't see a reason why you need to sell your home if you got real money, because why would you give up the continuation of accruing a value asset in Massachusetts where housing prices just keep going up?
Yeah. So, hey, speaking of the tea, since last we talked, there's a new general manager.
Yeah, General Manager Ng. It's actually nice to see for the first time in a long time now, a person that actually knows something about public transit.
An engineer, yes.
An engineer ran the Long Island transit system in New York. Long Island is not a wealthy community. It's not like you're running Manhattan. And it's actually I've been to Long Island City. It's a nice place. I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a New York guy. I don't go there enough. It seemed nice the last time I visited, but it's, you know, more of a working class areas in Long Island City, as well. I mean, like Amazon warehouse was a big fight over there about job creation and these empty industrial lots. I don't know if people remember that story, but I mean, it was a huge conflict between some of the politicians versus some of the folks that need work. So there's a lot of old industrial stuff out there, and, you know, he took a failing system and it, you know, and brought it back to a functional system. But this is also the second oldest public transit system on the planet, next to London, oldest one in the US, over 100 plus years old. And as I talked about last time, is a non-conforming system that much of it doesn't actually meet modern standards. It looks like, based on our conversations with the T. So I think it'll be very interesting. He's got a lot of things to deal with. Infrastructure, a budget that's very challenged. Again, ridership is a significant part of the budget. And he's got to hire a lot of people.
Yeah. He's already scheduled a job fair, actually, just the week that he begins his new job in April. So he realizes that's got to be a top priority.
And people's attitudes really change about work. I mean, you know, over my lifetime, I remember way back when people were like clamoring to get a job at the T. Now you say the T, people are nearly as interested. Young people don't want to work, you know, replacing ties. I mean, it's backbreaking work. It's, you know, good pay for young folks, but they're more interested in white collar desk jobs rather than, you know, honestly, very physical labor. But at the same time, the trades are very strong. I mean, a lot of tradesmen going around in certain sectors. A lot of electricians and plumbers are.
Oh yeah, you can write your own ticket pretty much in the trades. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people still join the trade union too. It isn't like they're have a shortage of people who are not trying to get in there right now. And there is a labor shortage there as we, reach a combination of COVID impacts on workforce as well as people moving on to retirement, as we just talked about a few minutes earlier. Mm-hmm. So, the T is not just competing for transit workers, they're competing for a whole different economic system than it was from 25 years ago, where a lot of people are moving to different style trades. People want to stay in a four-year education despite the costs. And attitude about work is different now. It's also a pro-worker market. Workers are making the demands on what they should be paid, and taxpayers hate to hear about that. But, the government is in a competitive situation with private sector, and we've always been in a competitive situation in the private sector. So if we can't pay wages, comparatively speaking, well, big surprise, they're going to walk with the wallet.
Exactly. Yeah. Even cities, towns have realized that as well. They just can't compete in the private sector, and folks are fleeing public service.
Yeah. Out there, anybody that is listening to us now say, well, I'll stay in public service for a 20% pay cut compared to the private sector for the same work. Yeah. People ain't stupid. They will walk with their wallet.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Because I love that when I get those phone calls about public employees. I'm like, will you take a 20% pay cut for working the government? No. Well, what are you complaining about?
Yeah. No. I mean, there's other benefits, of course. There's the pension and the health insurance, things like that you have to weigh in consideration. But you put it all together, and you're going to go with the best offer, right?
Yeah. I mean, the state pension system starts people at about 10% of your pay goes to the pension program. Social Security, I believe, is still at 6.5%. Even though paid family leave is a little bit quirkier because it's just about the same, but it's a little bit different because of the way we finance it, shared cost. And I got the pension program, but I don't know where this myth about 20 years comes in. There's no such thing as a 20-year rule unless you work at the MBTA. Everywhere else.
I think even that's gone there now.
Yeah, I think they have to change that. They're in a pension liability. They won't admit it. But I mean, to get to put in perception, I mean, as much as people love reading Howie Carr, to get to 80% of your pension, it isn't public safety or certain limited other professions. I mean, if you started working at age 20, you have to get 40 years of service in. So that means at age 60, you get your first shot at 80% of your top three salary. That's a lot of years.
Right.
We live in a world where most people change jobs, like changing hats within the first 5 years. And now the very strong labor market dictating terms, workers can change their hats three times in 1 year if the price is right.
Absolutely, especially if you're a younger person. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, as we all know, when you're younger and you're single, you have different responsibilities and different needs versus, as you get older, you may have a family or you're just getting older and you want to prepare for your own exit of workforce too. Unfortunately, hit that age, I got to start thinking about that part of my future.
I'm right there with you, Tag. I know. as you know, there's talk about raising the minimum wage again. What do you think?
Let's see how it plays out. I mean, as I've said before, if an organization doesn't have something to advocate, then why do you exist? Let's be frank about this, folks. If you don't have advocacy, then why are people paying you to advocate for nothing, right? And it happened last time we raised the minimum wage right after we got to the last cap. Immediately they filed for something else. And I'm kind of scratching my head like, well, do we know what the impact on this one is? And also given the strong wage market, I'm pretty confident $20 an hour is probably not the minimum anymore, particularly in a high cost of living states like Massachusetts, New York City, Washington State, LA, and so forth. The high cost of living here has to compete with wages. And we talk about wage inflation a lot here as part of overall inflation too. The question really becomes, does this become like 2008? We had wage deflation.
Yeah.
People forgot. We actually did have wage deflation in 2008, especially in the white collar industries where they took serious pay cuts because of the 08 recession. And those pay cuts were still there for a minimum of 5 years in many places. And you're doing more work for less money. essentially, you know, we weigh it out. And, you know, wage increases didn't really start again to after 2015. And it really kind of like the entire working, all workers are starting to see some wage increases. And of course, you know, the last year has been just out of control. I mean, average of 5% wage increase every month on average in 2022. No one's seen anything like this in 50 years, I think. I mean, no one, it's unheard of. 55% average wage increase every month in the whole year.
Yeah, I know. And one of the arguments, of course, is that's part of what's fueling inflation.
Absolutely, because it's cost passed on to you. You get paid more in the retail, that cost is passed on to customers. Unlike minimum wage, where you're looking at, you know, dollar increases a year over multiple years, so it's kind of factored in as part of the long-term cost of doing business. I mean, 5% a month at a buck, I mean, that's a lot more than a dollar a year when you really think about it. And that's just the average is five. I'm not saying that is for everyone. That's just the average. So, I mean, retained workers right now, last year was 14% was the average to retain. And offers for new stuff was up to 7% for new workers above medium from prior year. So wage growth has slowed down in 2023. It's only 3-4 months now. But, I mean, it seems to have slowed as the economy slows. And if we had another recession, if that happens, I don't know what recession will look like if it does happen, because I have no clue anymore. This is so unconventional. Will there be wage deflation? Will, you know, Main Street start to lower wages as a result of inflation? And does the white collar higher end paid in also engage in wage deflation because of overall recession and the challenges of doing business? I have no idea. I mean, this is like a big complete mystery that normally I would tell you. You know, recessions does impact wages, but we're not in a normal situation.
Boy, that's true. Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see what the Fed does for the rest of the year, if they're going to hold on interest rate hikes, if they're going to increase incrementally, or if they're going to even cut.
But SVB situation and Silvergate and Signature Bank and, of course, overseas Credit Suisse, you know, has created, you know, a lot of paranoia in the banking industry. And I think hundreds of millions of dollars have been moving around on deposits, particularly people who are not FDIC insured. I mean, anybody over $250,000. And I think it's going to take a little time for people to settle in, because, again, everyone's so unsure what's going on. And one little bit of bad news is cause a ripple effect, a change in businesses. Because, you know, obviously people want security and people want to be sure their money's safe. And, you know, it's not unreasonable. And any hint of bad news in an uncertain environment, you know, people are going to do what it takes to keep their assets safe so they can continue to do their business.
Let's talk a little bit about, I read a report just this morning, Tacky, about the generation of energy coming from renewable sources is at the highest point it's been quite a while, actually, putting coal second for the first time in this country, which I was shocked to hear.
Yeah, this is decades in the making. You know, I was around when we did deregulation of energy in Massachusetts. And one of the big challenges was, of course, you know, adding more renewable power back in 2000 into our energy portfolio. The problem was the energy, the desire for more renewable powers was there, but the production didn't exist. Mm-hmm. You can ask all you want for windmills, but there are no windmills. You're not going to get windmill energy. So through a lot of investment, not just us, but also in the federal level, through renewable things like renewable energy credits, tax credits for people to self-generate at home, we call that as net metering, you know, the ability for the feds, you know, over many years to do float big bond bills, to do more infrastructure improvements, and you know, individual states, you know, changing their energy portfolio. We you know, we have been shifting on a national level to more self-generatable power. And you know, there is no import exporting really, because it's electricity generated within the ISO area, which is, you know, multiple states. Except that one little piece of Texas we talked about last year, they had the ice storm. They're not part of the interstate because they're inside Texas. So the federal government has jurisdiction on interstate utilities, not because they're utilities, because the lines move interstate and they all touch each other, except that one little piece of Texas.
And we saw how that worked.
Well, that worked, not having the feds around to keep an eye on you. But not only we bleed into Canada, for example, Halifax is part of the electrical grid in Massachusetts, right? It's not strictly Massachusetts. Whatever happens in Halifax could potentially affect us. So what I'm getting at is very simple, is that, you know, we spent 20 plus years on not federal and individual states making massive investments in renewable power and a lot of subsidies. Let's call it what it is, folks. It's subsidies. Let's not pretend they're not, to get them all started. And, you know, I was in the battle and continue to be battling about peeling back some subsidies because they're making a lot of money. And, you know, the question is, particularly in utilities and energy, especially in energy business, because everybody needs energy. You know, how far do we continue to subsidize industries which they need you? I mean, you need them, right? You turn on the power, you need them, whether it be a mm-hmm. solar panel or a natural gas fire plant, right? And the fossil fuels, you know, yeah, they get tax subsidies in the feds, but they get no subsidy really down here at our level.
Right.
Yeah. But renewables do. And it comes out of your, most of it actually comes out of your gas electric bill. Your distribution rate pays for those subsidies. So at some point, you know, this conversation is going to shift where the industry is going to like rally up the environmental advocates to maintain subsidies. And, you know, and some of these people are going to be people advocating against, you know, reforming the estate tax. So you and your parents are able to get proper taxation on estates. It mm-hmm. reflects the real world, not this kind of archaic way here. This is kind of the advocacy I deal with, right? You got people who want to maintain subsidies for multi-billion dollar energy companies. Meanwhile, they don't want to help our parents, and maybe we'll grow old enough to leave something behind for future generation and state tax that is reasonable and reflective of the real world of the entire country. This is kind of what I deal with, right? I kind of scratch my head and look, people, as you can imagine. But I mean, there's also a drawback to this too, because as we develop the windmills offshore, that's still in route. It seems like the main thing is starting to reach ahead on a conclusion on hydropower from Quebec. And given the high energy prices that we had to face a few times this winter, I mean, we actually did go to coal as mm-hmm. an energy source for short spans, which was very, very, very unfortunate. And part of that is because we don't have enough natural gas as a bridge. So you're forced to coal. And we don't have nuclear because nuclear is shutting down all over the place, which is actually a clean form of energy, despite what you think about the Manhattan Project. It is actually a lower death rate than it is than coal or natural gas plants. But that's neither here nor there. Building a nuclear power plant is cost prohibitive without major guarantee of customers. So, you know, we did have to tip into coal this winter. There's just not enough natural gas as the bridge while we're waiting for power lines and blades to go up over, you know, off the coast.
Yeah, it's a transitional period, right? It's like kind of equated to trying to turn a huge cargo freighter on a dime. It just doesn't happen quickly.
Yeah, I'd rather transition using a lower danger emission power source on the way to even less emission power sources. So like I said, I'd rather not ever be on coal on the way to renewable. But the battles against natural gas. Well, guys who battle natural gas, we had coal this winter.
So there you go. Yeah.
Well, it ain't, you can look it up in the ICE New England profile charts too. You can see how much coal New England had used coal energy this winter.
Everything old is new again, but when it comes to freezing or living, you're gonna go with living.
Agreed. This is a state that requires natural gas to go to heating homes first before generating electricity. So the gas-fired power plants basically don't get natural gas as much as it diverted to home heating. It is New England. And it's not just us. It's a regional issue. I remind folks, energy is not just a Massachusetts matter. It is a regional issue because of the way ISO and the transmission lines work. And gas lines are interstate. So as we move into the warmer weather and energy prices seem to have stabilized, you know, oil is floating about $70 a barrel. And, you know, you got Ukraine and, you know, you got all these other countries moving, renewing their industrialization because COVID's not over. These are countries that are moving to try to move to first world from second world, and they need, unfortunately, fossil fuels to get them to first world. You know, that process was stalled because of COVID. Energy prices, if you're on basic service, meaning utility driven price, I mean, there's like going to be almost a 40% drop on your bill you're going to see coming May. Do I still encourage people to conserve power? Absolutely. I mean, you should try to reduce your load, even if the prices go down. But I mean, there'll be a little bit of relief you're going to see starting on May 1st.
Yeah, that's good news for sure. What's coming up on Beacon Hill in the next month or so, Tacky?
Well, we just did the Chapter 90 transportation bill. I mean, $1.8 million of free money to the city of Quincy, essentially, because we're paying for those bonds. And you got, some $150 million in that bill for emergency or shovel-ready type of improvements city towns may need for supplemental costs on things that, like, need today's situation. The governor found another supplemental budget, which I'm a little surprised by, but, you know, I'm probably going to sit on that one after the main budget's done, I think. I think it's going to be quiet next week unless we called in to vote on the conference committee report on the Chapter 90 bill. The governor's probably going to sign the first supplemental budget we did that dealt with things like, you know, school lunches and SNAP programs and other and workforce development programs that are running out of money because the demand's very high. The budget comes out the 12th of April, so I'm not anticipating a whole lot of activity heading to 12th, other than public hearings have gone off on a lot of committees as I'm still working with my co-chair and getting people in my committee up to speed and getting my hearing schedule set. We're a little bit behind on that compared to the chairs that already have their same chair from last time. So that pre-existing working relationship allowed them to move quicker. But I'm in a square one relationship situation. The House Asian Caucus is meeting Chair Ways and Means today, talking about, you know, statewide issues involving Asian Americans. We talked to the Asian American Pacific Islander Commission yesterday, got caught up on their work. I got the English Consulate hosting legislators tomorrow evening. You know, go by and drop in and say hi to the Consul General from Great Britain. You know, do my hellos there. So I mean, there's stuff going on, but I think overall in terms of legislative right now in the sessions is going to be required. But the hearings are going and all these meetings are happening, the briefings are happening as we close in on budget season.
So the House Speaker and Senate President both say the state auditor does not have the authority to audit the state legislature. What do you think?
Well, you saw the good speaker in OTR over the weekend. You can watch that on YouTube. He's looking great. He is from Quincy, and we love Rod. But the both the House and the Senate legal counsels have sent their official positions based on their review that, you know, the separation of powers is real. And if you have one branch dictate to the other branch, particularly the legislative branch, you know, who actually runs that branch, right? And this is not just a policy matter, but also operational matter. People are reminded again that during COVID situation, the governor's state of emergency did not apply to the House and Senate chambers. We run our own branches. And while the governor could declare state emergencies, it is up to the individual branches to decide of how to handle said state emergency. So when I was here for 9/11 as a staffer, you know, and to clean out the building, it's the scariest day in terms of the fact that, you know, we get bomb threats all the time. We just kind of like, until the bomb sniffing dogs and state troopers comb the building, we don't worry about it, right? Threats are not unusual at the State House. It's just that none of them rise to the level of we need to evacuate until we got to 9/11. And it was up to the Senate President and the House Speaker at the time to decide if they're going to hold a session the next day and where they were going to hold it. And there was actually discussions that, you know, we would go to the old State House because that's still under state control. And we could use that a chamber for holding sessions in case, you know, the state Golden Dome is targeted. But the decision was made at the end that, you know, we return to our respective chambers and continue with business during that emergency. Meanwhile, we had the Boston bombing and we had to hold sessions in the chamber. We didn't hold formal sessions in the Boston bombing because we, you know, evacuated Boston. But leadership team was in the chambers to hold informal sessions to try to get money through for public safety in a very timely manner. We were just moving money from the reserve during the Boston bombing. We need that overtime money now, as well as other purchases that public safety all around the greater Boston area needed. Even during COVID, the leadership teams were in the House Senate chambers, despite the fact, you know, no travel order. You can't stop. It is against the Constitution to have the executive branch ever stop a legislator from entering the state house. Now coming out is a whole other matter, right? But they can't impede our ability to enter the state house. I know these sounds like extreme examples, but it reflects the separation of power between the legislative and executive branches. And, you know, what a state auditor is looking for, she has never stated what she wanted to look for. The speaker continues to remind folks that we do our independent audits. We run like a mid-sized business when you think about it. And those audits are available in the House of Senate Clerk. I've noticed that none of the media folks nor the state auditor has actually talked about the ones in the clerk's office. You can go get yourself, which I find fascinating. It's like, hey, public document, help yourself. And neither the media nor the auditor have indicated they help themselves.
I guess one of the issues that I heard the auditor bring up was the subcommittee votes that she thought should be made public. Are those public?
Well, one, the auditor is not the Secretary of State Public Records Division.
Okay.
Again, what is she looking for, right? I mean, she's making a statement on something that, one, she worked there. She should already know the answer to. And it's a much to do about nothing in the end. I mean, the way that the reports are done to the House of Senate Clerk, and you're welcome to go to the House of Senate Clerk's office and get these committee reports. If you dissent or you reserve your right, you're listed to do that. You know, same as conference committee reports. It's pretty obvious how that vote goes, people. If you look at a sheet at the jacket in the clerk's office and it says, you know, nobody dissented or voted to reserve their rights, duh.
It's passed, unanimous, right? Yeah.
Okay. That's why I kind of ludicrous about this conversation. It's like, dude, if you're that dumb, you can't figure that out on your own. I don't know what to tell you. This is, I think, that everyone but the advocates can figure out on their own. And I find it perplexing that I'm confident that 99.99% of you all listening to this can figure this out. But that teeny tiny part of the group that's advocating can't.
Are those online, Tacky? Are those posted online?
No, they actually are posted. They actually are available in the House of Senate Clerk's office. You can call over there and get them. I mean,
okay.
Pinnacle lazy in some ways, right? I mean, for God's sakes, I was before internet, same as you.
Mm-hmm.
You got stuff by getting it.
Okay.
You know, it's one of those things I'm like, how lazy are people? I mean, it's like a work ethic issue, I swear. And it's not, I don't want, people blame young people all the time. Like, no, it's not young people. It's pervasive. You know, like when I started working, doing constituent calls, I mean, I discovered that, you know, people were pretty patient because we had no email, we had, you know, fax machines, there was no internet searches, and people were very patient with us, you know, on the phone because they knew we had to go get information, we'll call you back, and it takes time. So, yeah, I mean, I worked in the era before that stuff and noticed that we took phone calls on patient people being very patient. And as the longer I did constituent calls over time, realized the patient shrank because of the nature of the internet. And it used to be just younger folks that were very, very impatient, expecting an answer in 10 minutes. But it pervasive into the older generation, I've noticed over time, because of their level of patience has shrank to much younger folks as well. And then the volume is different because, you know, we used to get postcards and phone calls, and now you're getting emails that many are probably familiar is drowning you. And then you have to weed out junk mail. And then we have the cyber attack emails that we have to make sure we delete those because information has been catched on the way through. And we get these email warnings, don't touch this, don't touch that. You know, so I mean, yes, I'm moaning and groaning about work ethic of the world today, folks. I am now like old.
Use kids today.
You know, when did I become this? But I mean, you know, I tell a lot of the younger reps, you know, a lot of the timetables we work on now was done before the ability to file electronically.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember typewriters.
Oh yeah. And they're still in use in some cases. They're required, I know, for certain documents.
Yeah. And whiteout, how to get it just right, blow on it, Make sure it's smooth and tape on top of the whiteout. Or the blue out, because we had blue papers. Blue out was impossible to find.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I don't remember that one. I do remember Quincy Typewriter Service right on Maple Street. I miss them terribly.
Oh, yeah, because the House and Senate had blue and gold papers for typing up bills. So the cover pages had to be blue, but the inside could be plain white paper. So so you would have to type the titles because it didn't run through the computer printer, the printer properly, because it's you fold it and it just jams. So then we had to find blue out. No joke.
I believe you. Yeah.
Blue out was like a precious commodity in the Senate at the time.
Take some blue food coloring and add it to white out. Make your own.
So I think some of the young folks like looking at crazy. Some of the older folks, I think, understand exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
I did it all by hand. I mean, it was like legit. I mean, there's like, I actually had to do that work. So a lot of stuff that my staff does and other people talk to me, I was like, yeah, I physically did the same thing you did.
Yeah. Anything coming up in the district in the springtime?
April's really quiet overall. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that the city's going to be having their kickoff with the John Adams Presidential Library Dinner coming up on the 11th. I'm trying to think what else. I know there's some spring cleanups for various neighborhoods. I know the PTO events have started a little bit. AAPI month will be coming up in May. I got to get ready for those things. My office is preparing some, we could talk about more, but briefings regarding Asian Americans and mental health as part of our May informational session for the State House membership and their staff, and what, updating about where we are in those areas. I'm looking to, work with the Boston Institution of Asian American Studies about their initiatives a little more. We had a briefing a couple of weeks back with them. We'd like to do another update, probably another 2 or so months, to see where they are regarding their projects. And the Asian Commission, the AAPI, the Asian American Pacific Island Commission, updated us about some of their efforts on outreach around the state. For example, there's a big Bhutanese population in Low area that none of us really thought about or knew about. And other Asian ethnic groups that you'd be surprised how many there are. And I am always surprised too. And I got to think about that, not like right away, but down the road, about reaching out and seeing what their issues are. People kind of forget I'm a district guy in Quincy at home, but I am a statewide guy too, in kind of a peculiar way, not just as a committee chair, but also working on Asian American issues on a statewide level. So there's a lot going on. And obviously, the fundraising season's already started with local officials. I need to get moving on mine. And historically, what I've always done was that, I let everyone locally go first, as I'm kind of figuring out when they finish. And then as a courtesy, I go after them, because, if you got an election this year, you feed yourself first, so to speak. And it's quiet in the Western Front in Quincy. I don't hear a whole lot going on local elections just yet.
No, nor do I. It will start soon, I think, for sure.
Yeah, the council needs to set a schedule at some stage. Nomination papers and set the dates for the preliminary and the final. We'll see how it goes. But April thus far, other than standard things like Patriots Day and the marathon and so forth, I'm not thinking of anything, either local or Boston in the month of April. I'm very interested in May because of graduation season. Because mm-hmm. Huge economic impact in Massachusetts during graduation time.
People come from all over here. There are students here from all over the world. So absolutely, it's a major influx of cash.
Yeah, my uncle's goddaughter studies at BU. And, she had to do this remote learning during COVID from China. And she was very happy to come back. But she also missed seeing her family when she got here because she couldn't go back.
Yeah.
First opportunity she did, she went back and spent a week, plus with her family. But now her family's coming up here for graduation. So it's amazing, talking to her and her 4 years of BU, how quickly I blink and now she's graduating from college. And I can't wait when my nephew graduates. I'll be like, where's time gone, right? So, international student families will be coming in for graduation. And that's economic stimulus for Massachusetts. So I'm kind of curious how it's going to work. I ran to the hallway, one of the government affairs people for Expedia. And I asked her straight up, you know, what the numbers look like. And she goes, well, in this region, a lot of UK Brits are still coming over despite the strong US dollar, which discouraged people traveling to US because it's the exchange rate doesn't work in their favor. So I actually will work to try to get a briefing of her from Expedia to get a little bit of the big data of where people are coming and going. It gives us an idea of, you know, what the future of economic stimulus is. And we talked about earlier, like the film industry, right? Matt Damon, you know, there was a truck accident yesterday on the power line, but down to Maliki's and doing a filming there. And the fact that a lot of that movie is being shot in the greater Boston area, and they have to rent local businesses, and they have to rent your restaurant or bakery or whatever, pay for police details, and you know, get everything from like potta potties to catering. You know, film industry, you know, continues to be coming to Massachusetts, and that's money for us. You know, also free advertising.
Yeah, I mean, there's a film production studio at Marina Bay, so it's definitely part of the economy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've always found that if a film gets out and the people want to see where the film's been shot, AKA, you know, were you going to use Cheers as our favorite example from the 80s TV show and Spencer for Hire? You know, it does bring attention to the Boston and greater area for people to visit. Amistad's another example. The Perfect Storm's another example. Even Here Comes the Boom for Franklin Park Zoo was an increase outside visitors to come see the place. So, you know, I hope, you know, the industry continues and basically gives us free advertising around the world, but also, you know, perhaps some domestic tourism, you know, for people who want to see some film sites.
Yeah, absolutely. Time to tell folks how to get a hold of you, Techie.
Well, we are in the office in room 42, 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. You can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. You know, feel free to email me. You guys know the drill. Priority goes to people with real problems first. So, you know, not like your advocacy for policy isn't important, but you can't get your unemployment benefits slightly higher in the food chain, right? And, you know, obviously you can reach us at the state the MA Legislature, malegislature.gov, can reach us there. It's the state website. And I have Tacky Chan Twitter @TackyChan and State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. Don't social media contact. It doesn't work. I have enough places to hunt me down. So please email or phone call me. Easier for me to keep track of where you all are as I'm kind of reading all this stuff. And of course, you know, you and I are here on a weekly basis, Joe. QE TV, and might as well shout out to Mark, because Mark, shout out to you. Mark Crosby has me on his whatever the name of that show is.
State View,
which will be broadcast, as Mark reminds me, beyond the Quincy area. So I've been exposed to other communities, which I don't know. I don't know how that's going to go.
Well, you'll find out, I'm sure, when you get some feedback from, Fitchburg or something.
Perhaps, I'm kind of curious. But at the same time, I mean, this medium's awesome because I can have my family see me every so often, if they so desire, from outside the state, but also all over the world, just in case they want to see what I look like and what I do. So this has actually been a great medium on a personal level.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad. I'm glad we've been able to help you with that. And we appreciate it, too. We appreciate you using our access center here in Quincy.
No, absolutely. I admit it was great to be back in person in the studio, Mark. It's nice to see everyone.
There is no substitute for in person. It's no substitute for it. Yep.
No, unless you have a voice for radio, as you remind me.
The type of face for radio. Next time we talk, it'll be April.
Yeah, everyone have a good start to spring. Enjoy April Fool's Day this Saturday. The hill's going to be a little bit busier, and you might actually do a few more of these from the office, particularly once we get to budget week.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Thanks a lot, Techie.
You all take care.